fall. Baby, it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We come. Grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're starting up our second hour with Patrick Wood, and boy, welcome back, Patrick Wood. You just ended up on that 27-member special committee that gave us this Agenda 2030 or 2030 agenda. Could you continue with that? Boy, that is fascinating what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is just such a great story, and it just shows you how these people work. You see the pattern. You see the MO, the modus operandi, how these people work. So here's what happened. When Podesta's first group, the 27-member group, and I'll read the title of that group. I just love this. I laugh every time I read it. This original panel was called, quote, the high-level panel of eminent persons on the post-15 development agenda, close quote. It doesn't that just tickle your funny bone that these people have such an ego?
Agenda 2030 for the people.
Oh, my gosh.
My gosh.
Well, here's what happened.
Yeah.
On May 30 in 2013, that group concluded its work. They gave their findings to the United Nations, which, again, that finding was called A New Global Partnership, Eradicate Poverty and Transform Economies Through Sustainable Development. They passed that back to the UN. That has since become the 2030 agenda document that will be signed on the 25th, or at this next meeting. Now, Podesta left this high-level panel of eminent persons and immediately went to work for President Obama. Immediately. As a senior policy advisor in charge of climate change policy, he proceeded to take his findings of climate change policy and architect, if you will, a plan for Obama to follow on implementing climate change policies in America. It was Podesta that did this. Just came off the UN, comes to work for the president, works up an architecture for him, a very specific plan, gives it to the president, and then earlier this year, Podesta's work was done, and he left and became Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. We'll leave Podesta there for now. So what happened here, in the meantime, last November, the New York Times, of all places, writes an article on John Podesta. Now, you know the New York Times is not a conservative newspaper, right? They're basically an organ for progressive thought in America. But they wrote an article about John Podesta, and they're proud of him because he's one of their boys. And they said in this article that it was John Podesta who single-handedly developed President Obama's climate change policy. Single-handedly, they said. That's exactly what he did. Obama doesn't know, and I'll say this, Obama doesn't know squat about climate change. He doesn't know anything about science or engineering either. He doesn't know anything about this stuff. He doesn't know anything about sustainable development. But when the time comes to place this kind of a policy into play, somebody like John Podesta comes sweeping in out of the blue, works for a time side by side with the president, gives him the most major policy he will ever have in his life, and says, here, go do this now. I've given it to you. You do it, Buster. And that's why we call these people handlers. You know, Obama is the handlee.
Right.
People like Podesta are the handlers.
Right.
They gave him the policy. Lock, stock, and barrel. Everything Obama's implementing today came from the pen of John Podesta.
Man.
This is the policy that the rest of the world is going to sign on to on the 25th of September.
Do you see that they're moving towards just a number of corporations that have absolute dominance over all trade, more like almost corporate fascism with a communist mass at the bottom using their services? Something like that? What do you think?
That is usually the first conclusion that somebody will come to.
Yeah.
And because we only understand things in terms of what we already know. I realize that. I've been there, done that so many times, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can understand something is by what your experience has been.
Okay.
So if you know anything about communism, Marxism, fascism, and so on, it's so easy to say, that this is what that is. And it does have lots of similarities. Especially in the area of totalitarianism, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
You know, and sure. We understand the word totalitarianism, but usually in the context of the Soviet Union or China or some of the other countries like, well, Argentina, whatever. But here's the difference, and this is a subtle thing, but technocracy is not capitalism. It's an otherworldly economic system. It is not capitalism. And we need to understand that because this new system that they're calling sustainable development is just warmed over technocracy from the 1930s. And we can go back historically and look at technocracy. We know exactly what it was. We can analyze it six ways to Sunday. We know what they were attempting to do, and we know that it was not capitalism. They wanted to get rid of capitalism. They were certain that capitalism was going to completely fail and that they would be able to have a scientifically operated society run by scientists and engineers, not politicians. They wanted to do away with all politicians. They wanted to get rid of Congress. They wanted to get rid of all the bureaucracy up and down the line. And they always wanted to have scientists and engineers running everything with their hand directly on the throttle. No intermediary. And so this was different than what we have ever had in terms of capitalism and free enterprise. So when Christiana Figueres got up earlier this year at a press conference in Europe, when she said at that press conference, and I'll quote this again, she said, quote, "This is probably the most difficult task we've ever given ourselves," which is, here's the key words now, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. Now, this is a pregnant statement. She's not pregnant. I'm just saying this is a pregnant statement, right? Because it's full of stuff. They're going to intentionally transform the economic development model. Well, that's capitalism and free enterprise. Secondly, it's never been done before. She admits it's for the first time in human history. There's never been attempted before to change the economic development model. Elsewhere in that same press conference, she said, this is the first time in the history of mankind, again, history and all the history of mankind, that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, there's timetable, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution, close quote. Now, you see, this is not capitalism free enterprise. This is different. What we need to do is ask ourselves, how is it different? How different would it look from today? You know, you got people like the Pope is bashing capitalism and free enterprise and all the excesses and stuff that we know are there that aren't right, but those are aberrations. it doesn't invalidate the basic principle of free enterprise and private property. But we have all these people talking different ways about capitalism and free enterprise without anybody asking a question, can you tell me about this other economic development model? What's that? That's what I'm doing. I know now, at least I know this, I know it's technocracy. They call it green economy. They call it sustainable development within the UN. I call it technocracy because that's what it is. That's where it came from. This is nothing new in that sense. But if they implement this system of sustainable development, it's not going to look anything like capitalism ever looked. And you realize when you talk about socialism, for instance, communism, the only argument there over the economy was, who's going to control the economy? Is the economy going to be controlled by the people with supply and demand, free will, supply and demand, or is the government going to control the economy? That's the only question. It was still capitalism. They're just arguing over who's going to control it. Hitler did the same thing. China did the same thing. It's still capitalism. They still have a currency. It trades internationally. They still have basically supply and demand in terms of trade and stuff around the world. It's still capitalism. Even though there's some communism and fascism wrapped in, it's still capitalism. But this new thing, sustainable development, and aka technocracy, it's otherworldly. It's not the same. And even the United Nations recognizes and admits that this is the first time in human history that that system has ever been changed. Do you follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah, it looks like totally planned technocracy by the technocrats, right?
That's right. There is no concept of property rights. There's right. No concept of any kind of free trade. Everything is engineered. They decide what will be produced, not you. You see, in our world, if somebody builds a better mousetrap and you like that mousetrap, well, you might just go out and buy it. You might make that person that invented it rich.
Right.
But consumers have always been the drivers of what companies make. If there's no market, they quit making it. Just that simple. The technocrats don't think that way. The technocrats think, what's good for the people? What are we going to make them? What are we going to make them this week? Well, in China, they decided, well, we're going to make them some nice, shiny new cities. By golly, they need cities. We decided the people need cities. We'll build a few cities. So they dropped a few billion dollars here and there, and they built cities, turned into ghost cities in the end, because people said, heck no. Not just no, but heck no.
You're not getting
to those cities. And so they didn't go to the cities. But this is the technocrat's mindset. They will decide what will be produced, and then secondly, they will tell you personally what you are allowed to consume. And you might say, well, you know, I'd like to go out and buy myself a nice car. And they might just say to you, no, you can't buy a car. You live in the city and you can't buy a car in the city. You have to ride a bicycle to work or whatever. If you want to get around, you have to ride a bicycle or you have to take the bus or the train, but you can't buy a car. Well, you might say, I want to take a trip and go to Seattle.
Right.
They might come back and say, no, you've exceeded your carbon footprint for the last 3 months in a row. And, you're not allowed because of that. You're not allowed to get on an airplane and make your carbon footprint even worse. You see, This is insidious mindset. I'll tell you what. It is otherworldly. It's completely different than anything that you and I have ever conceived in our life. We've never had exposure to this kind of crap.
Yes.
These people are dead set against it. And one reason people don't understand what they're doing is because they can't understand what they're doing. They think, oh, it's just capitalism warmed over or something. Oh, it's just, you know, capitalism with something else thrown on top of it. No, it is not. If these people are successful at doing what they want to do, at the end of the road, there will be no property rights for anybody in the world. You and I will not be able to own a house, a car, property, real estate, stuff like that that we consider private property, businesses. They will own it all. They will control it all. You will not be able to build up wealth so that you might have an inheritance to leave your children or to take care of yourself in your retirement years, because they will say, we'll take care of you. You've got Obamacare after all.
Well, they're going to tell you when to retire by death panels or something, huh?
They're already doing that. They're already allocating health care. It's a fact. They're allocating health care right now. Yet, even though we as frogs are getting hotter and hotter in the water.
Exactly. Exactly.
People can't put, they can't connect the dots correctly to see where this is going. Where it's going is the total destruction of society as we know it today throughout the world, not just America, but everywhere.
Did they not early on for the last few decades teach our children about earth worship or nature worship or what?
Well, of course they have. I mean, that's all over.
Yes, that's everywhere. Over. The new age, right?
Yes, it is. It's all over.
So today there was an article that came out that said something about certain groups are calling for Obama to prosecute people that are against global warming or global change or whatever, weather change.
Yes.
There's a call by certain groups for Obama to start prosecuting these people that are activists against global warming.
Yes, we can probably thank somebody like Al Gore for that, who is a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah.
Because Al Gore said just a few months ago in a speech, he said, anybody who doesn't agree with climate change is just flat out a denier. That was a term of derision, right?
Right.
You're a stinking denier. If you don't go along with Al Gore and believe everything he believes, why, you're a denier. And so he then said, and deniers deserve to be punished. Now, I don't like that kind of talk.
Boy, that dangerous stuff.
This is dangerous talk because you're saying basically this is a concept from 1984.
Exactly.
If you don't think the right way, Buster, we're going to put the shock collar on you until you do.
Right.
And not only will you agree with us in the end, but you'll love us for it.
Or you're a useless eater and we're going to liquidate you.
If you just refuse to change your mind.
Yeah, we've got too many people, all these billions, so we're just going to process a bunch of people through, you know, to death, you know.
I know. So we're in dangerous territory here. This whole sustainable development business is a sea change movement.
Right.
Complete sea change. It is the most dangerous thing that's ever happened on the face of the earth. And I am not an alarmist, George. I'm not the kind of person that cooks something up to scare the crud out of people.
Right.
You know, get them to go out and buy gold bricks or something or food or whatever.
Right.
That has never been my intention. When I researched and wrote this stuff, I never had that in mind, and I still don't. This is just the fact of the matter. But people are missing this. They're scared about a whole lot of other things these days, and I might add that fear tends to paralyze people. People are fearful of a lot of things today, and that paralyzes them from using their brain to see who the enemy really is. And that's why we have not won this war. We have not won many battles, much less the war, in the last 40 years, George. And I've been out there fighting with the best of them. You know, I know most all of the people that fought communism along the way, people like David Noble, you know, some of the great, not political leaders, but, you know, just the popular leaders that are fighting against communism. Our ladder was leaning up against the wrong wall, George. That's all. We had good intent. We were serious about it. We loved our country. We loved the people we were trying to help. And all I can say is, looking back now, our ladder was leaning up against the wrong wall. And we are measurably worse off today than we have been in history, which to me is pure evidence that we have not fought the right enemy yet. We have not engaged the correct enemy yet. And unless we do, we will be defeated, most certainly. You cannot defeat, and I think Sun Tzu said this in 600, you cannot defeat an enemy that you have not recognized. That's true.
Right. So you're saying the enemy that we've got to address is who exactly?
Technocrats, technocracy,
yeah.
Sustainable development, climate change, all the things wrapped up in it. Let's wrap some few other things into it. Let's wrap in smart grid,
yeah.
For instance.
Yes, yes.
Let's wrap in Common Core education standards, for instance.
Yeah.
Let's wrap in councils of government. Councils of governments, which are all over our country today, they're patently unconstitutional. In many cases, they're patently illegal. And yet, when Bill Clinton started his reinventing government initiative in the 1990s, our government and our governance has radically changed to where there's a regional form of government in almost every state in our nation today. They're called councils of government. They're everywhere. I have one here in Maricopa County that is dictating land use policy and transportation policy.
Exactly.
To the entire area here, over 1 million people. In San Francisco, you have the ABAG organization, which is the Association of Bay Area Governments. It is a COGS, C-O-G-S, Council of Governments organization. They have authority over 101 cities, 9 counties, 7 million people. And they have sucked sovereignty away from every city and every county in the entire Bay Area. They now control land use policies for the whole area. They control wildlands projects for the whole area. They control transportation policy for the whole area. The cities just have to go along with what they say.
Yeah,
this is everywhere. All the stuff is wrapped into the same package.
You'll see at the World Economic Forum all this public-private partnership stuff.
They're
buying up everything. You know.
You betcha.
And they're using the credit of government, so to speak, to take over the infrastructure.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So what you're seeing in the future are just a limited number of the elitists through their corporations owning everything, and we own nothing.
That's where it's headed.
Huh?
That's where it's headed.
No personal property. We might have to rent it or something.
That's right.
But no real property. No public private property. Maybe like I say, rentals. Yep. We'll be living in these little one-room houses, maybe, huh?
Yes, that's right. You know, I mentioned the book 1984 by George Orwell.
Yeah.
We got to mention another book called Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Right.
And I'll tell you a very little known fact is that Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World in 1932 when technocracy was housed at Columbia University in New York City.
Oh, gosh.
He was looking into the face of technocracy when he got the inspiration for the book, George.
My gosh.
So did George Orwell. George Orwell was writing about technocracy when he penned 1984. He got his vision directly out of the technocracy playbook. In both cases, they're different books, granted. They are different books. They have a different angle. But the one thing they have in common, they both concluded that it will result in a scientific dictatorship. Where the system controls you, not a dictator per se, but the system controls you. And all of your behavior down, Orwell focused a little more on controlling the mind. Huxley focused a little bit more on controlling the body. It's the only difference there.
Have you ever taken the 22-3 September 2015 and put it into Google Maps? Have you seen that?
No.
If you do 23rd September and then 2015, CERN comes up over in Switzerland. and you know, you've got all these people, a little levity here, okay? You got all these people with all kinds of things they're saying. So we sat down at a restaurant the other day and these friends of mine are saying, I told them about this and they said, well, what do you think, George? And I said, look, somebody programmed that in there in Google. You know?
No kidding.
And then Eric Schmidt is saying here that new developments in machine intelligence will make us far more smarter as a result, and all this technocracy stuff you're just talking about.
Yes, indeed. And by the way, Eric Schmidt, 2.5 years ago, was inducted into the ranks of the Trilateral Commission.
Okay. Okay. It figures. When they reach a certain position there, then they bring them in, don't they?
Huh? Yep. He got tapped.
Yeah. And now they're saying that this year, I was looking at some statistics, there's 7 billion connections. You know what I mean? Internet, not internet connections, but a cell phone connections.
Yeah.
7 billion, that's a bunch, isn't it? It's almost one for every person in the world. I guess we're a little over that now. So, so this space fence, are you familiar with that? And I mean, it's electronic type of a prison they're creating, huh?
Well, that's right. That's exactly where it's headed.
And like you were saying, you wake up in the morning, you've got a card maybe it's embedded in your skin, who knows, and you go to the grocery stores and you put your wrist over the scanner, where you got a bread and milk and a few things, and then it says, I'm sorry, but you can't buy this. You're overweight right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, something like that, huh? Can you see that coming?
I absolutely can. They're already pursuing this kind of policy. In Oregon, they passed a law just a few weeks ago where, even though it's voluntary now, it'll be changing to mandatory later. I'm certain of it. But they're putting GPS devices inside of automobiles to track your mileage.
Right.
So that your mileage can be accumulated electronically, wirelessly at the end of the period. Sent off to a back office where they will calculate your miles in order to charge you a road tax in lieu of gasoline tax. They're gonna, they're just gonna figure out your exact mileage and stuff, and then they will send you a bill for the miles you drive. Well, we found this was a master plan of the Department of Energy, and we found a document that was done at the University of Iowa. They were working with the Department of Energy on this, and this document, this presentation that we got a hold of, said that the idea ultimately is to examine the driver's carbon footprint. Now, that would require access to the national database where everything is being collected, right? But they're going to analyze the carbon footprint of the individual based on the car they drive, kind of car they drive, their lifestyle. How big is their house? How many kids do they have? You know, what do they travel? Do they, you know, whatever. And then they're going to send each person a customized, tailored invoice for taxes. And if your footprint is, you know, it's kind of like your credit rating, right? Kind of think of it that way. If you got a credit rating, or if you got a carbon footprint that's really high, well, you're going to pay through the nose.
Right.
But if you got a carbon footprint, you're a good little boy, and you drive a Prius, and you ride your bike 3 times a week to work, and you know you take light rail to go downtown, and you only live in a 2-bedroom little bungalow somewhere or something. Why, you might even get money back. you might get a rebate.
You love the earth, then, right? I mean,
that's right.
It's about preserving Mother Earth, and we love Mama Earth, right?
That's right. You know? We will reward you, and we'll punish the other guy that's an offender. And they're already doing this in Oregon, and this is exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. Once they have their hand into this national database to figure out things like your carbon footprint and all the other things that you've been doing, then anything is possible. When you go out into life and try and do stuff, anything like you say is possible. To stop you from doing that at the point of purchase.
Oh my gosh,
I just read an article yesterday. I think it might have been on Drudge, but I read an article that Obamacare makes possible for corporations to punish employees who are fat.
Yeah.
Right now, they can punish them. Financially, I mean, they're not going to take them out and horsewhip them.
Well, the problem with, you know, looking at the 17 goals, you know what I mean, that were set out on this, 2030.
Yes.
When you go through those things, They're actually doing the opposite of that already with GMO and all these other things.
I know.
I mean, actually, that behind the scenes, they're creating a system of death treatment, not health treatment. You know what I mean?
I know.
That's what I see. It's so evil. See, they put forward this 2030 agenda. Everyone, no poverty, no hungry, mouths, and we're going to take care of everyone. And all the time, they're building it down scientifically.
That's right. That's right. You know, it would be almost a disservice to anybody listening that if we didn't read the original technocracy requirements from 1934.
Yes, do that.
So that people can see the connection to what's
okay.
going on.
Okay.
Because it's stunning. And these, you got to hand it to engineers. When an engineer's got a good project in front of them, they know how to document stuff. You know, they know how to, they get the quadrille paper out and they diagram it and they draw it and they list things out, you know, what you got to do to get a project done. Engineers are trained to do that kind of thing. And those engineers back in 1932, 3, and 4 were just like that. They were architecting a new scientifically managed society. So they really put themselves to the task to do that. Here, and they listed 7 total requirements that were necessary for technocracy to be implemented. And the first 5, I'm only going to read the first 5, and just see if you could pick up on this, if this is what's actually happened, because they said if you don't do these 5 things, you can't ever achieve technocracy. Here's number one.
Okay.
Requirement number one, quote, register on a continuous 24-hour per day basis the total net conversion of energy.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load. Close quote. I'll stop there just for a second.
Yeah.
Can you see smart grid in those 2 requirements?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll read the second one again.
And these new power meters fit perfectly into all this too, don't they?
That's right. By means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load. Now, every literature that you read from a utility company talks about balanced load. That's their mantra. That's what they're trying to do. Balance the load.
Yeah.
So that was the first 2 requirements of technocracy from 1934. Okay, number 3, quote, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Close quote. Number 4, quote, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc., of all goods and services, where produced and where used. Close quote. Now, number 5, quote, provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual, plus a record and description of the individual. Close quote. That's the first 5 requirements.
Yeah.
Now, can you see the total awareness society?
Yes, exactly. That's what
that
is. But let me make a point here too. Do you remember when the takeover occurred of England? Okay, by William the Conqueror and so on. You know, well they established what they called a Doomsday Book. You ever heard of that?
I haven't.
And the Doomsday Book was an inventory of all the property in the realm.
Okay.
And they started taxing all of that.
Okay.
So what this is, what you're saying, what they're proposing there was a complete inventory, see, of all the resources and those that would be consuming it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the purpose of this, in their minds, the reason to do this was so that they could control the society.
Yes.
Because you cannot control what you cannot monitor.
Right.
In an engineering project, like say you owned a factory, you set it up, you're a smart guy, you set up some kind of factory, and you maybe got 50 people working in your factory, and there's stuff coming and going, and machines are going whir, whatever. Well, you might make a lot of money on that factory, but I would guarantee you, you would put in some type of system of monitoring in order to, you know, be immediately notified if something goes wrong, or even if something goes right and you want to do it a little bit more of that. But you said it, you monitor your factory, you watch it like a hawk, because you need to know what's going on that factory floor all the time. And that's exactly the way these engineers look to society. We have to know what's going on. We have to be able to monitor in order to control. We have to have feedback. And somebody asked the question, well, how much data do you need, Mr. Scientist? And he would say, well, that's an oxymoron. There's never a limit to the amount of data that an engineer wants. He wants everything, if it were possible, every conceivable piece of data that existed. And ever. And, of course, you can't have that. You get what you can. But right now, you look at the all-encompassing data that's being grabbed up on Americans. This has nothing to do with
NSA that. Stuff is right there in the middle of this.
I know. This has nothing to do with national security whatsoever.
No. Uh-uh.
But you take all the phone calls, all the emails, you take all of the financial records, everything you purchased, because that's all credit card data, that's available to them. Everything you do on social media is recorded. Everything that you might be spotted in ways to locate you, whether by a cell phone, triangulation from towers, or facial recognition on a camera, all that stuff is fed back into the master database. You say, well, how much information is enough for these people? The answer is there's never enough. They want everything. They want your DNA, for crying out loud. They're getting that like crazy now too. They want your DNA from you and all your health records. They want everything about what you've ever done. They want all your education records and how you're able to learn and what your propensity to learn is. They want to know your psychographic profile. Everything they're collecting to do this. And I might add, you know, how did this come about? I mean, how did the NSA go rogue? Well, come to find out, I did some research on this. The NSA does not operate on its own. The NSA is a subsidiary of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's called the DNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The DNI is one person. He's the intelligence czar for the country. He operates all 16 agencies, intelligence agencies, budget, line item budget control, marching orders, all the interconnections and stuff. The DNI is a person that does this exclusively. So the facility in new NSA facility in Utah, for instance, I was shocked to find out that the NSA is operating that facility as an agent for the DNI. I found that in their own website. They're not operating it on their own behalf. They're on contract to operate that facility for the DNI. You follow? You see what the difference here I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're not rogue. They're not a rogue organization. They're under the complete authority of the Director of National Intelligence. Now, where did this person come from? George Bush started the National Intelligence Agency back on April 21, 2005. George Bush. Remember Dick Cheney? Was his vice president. Dick Cheney was a prominent member of the Trilateral Commission. The first ever director of national intelligence, George Bush appointed him, was Mr. John Negroponte. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission. Ha! This is the guy, George, that put together the entire intelligence structure that we see today that is sucking up all this information on every American. Has nothing to do with national security. It has to do with implementing technocracy. But here, again, a member of the Trilateral Commission sweeps in at just the right time, I'm talking about John Negroponte, to create this office to make all the right kind of connections between the agencies, to set them all up, to get the architecture moving forward and stuff, you know, the 5-year plan, the 10-year plan, all that stuff was done by a member of the Trilateral Commission. Okay. You see how this is all fitting?
Yes, it all fits together, doesn't it?
Oh, my gosh. This is huge. It's just huge.
Well, right now, in England, they've got big database research going on, and also here. But that's what they're trying to address. They're getting so much data now, they have to create new hardware and software to process it so that they can get a more scientific dictatorship going, rolling, see?
That's where the whole thing is headed in the end.
Yeah.
I had somebody suggest, well, just the fact that Negroponte set the whole thing up, that doesn't mean squat.
Yeah.
Well, how about this? When Obama came into office six years ago, he appointed Admiral Dennis Blair to be Director of National Intelligence. Guess what? Admiral Dennis Blair is also a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a good old boy club at the top, isn't it, huh?
Oh, my gosh. It goes beyond just the good old boy club.
Well, you know, it's a lot of these men that are failing because of ego or whatever. What would your idea be about men and their egos, and they're trying to be gods or something, or what? What's going on here?
Well, you know, you could make that charge against them if they have a God complex.
Sure, I mean, narcissism and all this, you know.
Well, if they figure that they're the master over the feedlot, you know, where you
exactly.
I mean, yeah, okay, you could say, well, they're like God.
They are.
They're lording it over everybody else.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's dangerous policy. I'll tell you, it's just dangerous policy. But the office of the DNI's position was not set up for the sake of national security. That's the biggest sham that I've ever seen in my life. It had nothing to do with the benefit of the American people. They architected the office of DNI so that they could accomplish and move forward this whole program of technocracy. That's what they're doing. And you remember the five requirements that I just read from 1934?
Right.
They're achieving that to the letter.
What were the other two, Patrick? There are two more?
There were two more. I don't have them right now. They're innocuous.
Oh, okay.
As far as our discussion is concerned.
Okay. But you're saying they're moving this thing forward pretty quick, aren't they?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Huh?
Absolutely, they are. You know, the whole smart grid thing, George, didn't surface until 2009.
Yeah.
That's only 6 years ago.
Okay.
And you know how it surfaced was in the middle of the financial crisis. Obama starts throwing out money like nilly-willy, you know, stimulus money, right?
Right.
He starts spreading money all over the place. Well, he'd give $100 million to anybody that asked for it, as long as it was a liberal cause or a, you know, somebody's going to make solar panels or something like that. They're spreading money all over the country.
Yeah. Well,
they spread a few hundred million to the utility companies to implement smart grid all over the country.
Right.
That's how it got started, with stimulus money. In the dead of night, when nobody was looking, Obama doled out this money through the Department of Energy to all the utility companies to kickstart smart grid. There was no public demand for smart grid before that, even though the technology had been offered as early as 1980 by utility companies. But now the Department of Energy forced it out by kickstarting the utility to get out there and do it. Now they've done it. What really disturbed me, George, was when I found out that other countries around the world had the same MO applied to them. And England, Germany, Italy, all over Europe, China, Mexico, you name it, stimulus money, which is taxpayer money, was given to utilities to implement smart grid technology in those countries. I immediately ask, who's pulling the strings here? Who's got the clout to go to 15, 20, or 30 countries and compel them to cough up stimulus money to build smart grid in their own countries? Well, I can just take a guess. It's somewhere along the way, there's members of the Trilateral Commission involved in that.
Yeah. There they are again, right?
but my point is, there is a global smart grid being created today as we speak.
Okay.
Not just national. They're planning on rolling up the data from all around the world into a single computer.
But the ecologists out there are not seeing the loss of their liberties and freedoms because of this, are they?
Well, they're just getting their paycheck from week to week.
No, but I mean, the people that have been conditioned into this, you know, nature, love of nature and preserve, you know, the environment, they're not really seeing that they're going to lose their liberties and freedoms, are they?
Well, no, they're not. They don't know what they are in the first place anyway. They enjoy some stuff. I'm sure people enjoy living in the U.S. of A.
But, I mean, they have good intentions, but they're being hoodwinked or deluded, aren't they?
Many of them are.
Huh?
Many of them have their eyes wide open. You have to ask, is the Pope ignorant?
They're all making money out of these things, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And that's a good point, too. When money flows, people go gaga.
All these environmental companies now that are cleaning up the thing here or doing that or recovery. There's a lot of these recovery type companies. See what I mean?
Yes.
Environmental recovery is seeing what I see on trucks now go by. See?
Yep. And for the most part, all those companies are just making money off the taxpayers.
Yeah, but there's always some government ordinance or new law out that requires da-da-da-da-da that requires new inspections and this and that, right?
That's right.
See?
Yeah.
And then off they go again to do all of this. Are you familiar with the Bilderberg Group much or not?
Yeah, I am, as a matter of fact.
And so, I mean, they're sitting up there pretty high in this pyramid of power. And I was over in Copenhagen. In 2014, last year, and we had our own, you know, symposium going, but we got really sabotaged on that deal. That's what it looks like to me.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They didn't want us having a meeting at all that would contradict what they were trying to do. But at that meeting in Copenhagen at the Marriott there, they had all of the top generals giving them briefings, all the MI6 and all that stuff there. The head of Bank of England, Mark Carney, was there. He's also head of the BIS, Financial Stability Board. That's a very powerful position.
Oh, yes, it is.
And it looks like to me now in the financial area is that they're still not out of the woods on these derivatives and stuff. What do you think?
Oh my gosh, no! The whole debt bubble,
yes,
that predicated our last financial crisis, has grown by over 20% since 2007.
Right.
Oh my gosh, we're worse off today than we were back then. And you would have thought with all the talk about reform and, you know, new regulations and stuff like that on the banking community, you would think somebody got smart and said, "Hey, we got burned this last time. We're not going to do that again." Well, no, it's just the opposite. They said we need to do more of it, not less of it. And so now the global debt bubble has been inflated beyond what it ever was before. And the risk is that the next crash is going to be much, much worse than the last one because all of the Federal Reserve systems of the world have exhausted their tools to do anything as far as recovery is concerned. They've spent all their bullets.
Right.
Already.
Well, is the Fed getting ready for a new quantitative easing round or not?
Some people think they are.
They didn't. They're not going up on rates here in the short term, so it could be quantitative easing ahead again.
It could be. And some people are actually already just very forcefully suggesting they're going to have to do that. But the thing is, quantitative easing has been proven to be a failure.
Yes, it is. I know. I mean,
it's total failure.
A friend of mine that's been in the investment business out of England and stuff for a year, he's an old friend of mine, says it's like pushing the one end of a string trying to anticipate the other end moving. It doesn't move, see?
That's right.
And when you pump up money itself, that does not establish industries and stuff and produce things. And you know,
right.
We're at the end. Now, one of the things I did uncover with my studies is that the Chicago markets, all of the derivative trading seems to be consolidated in those markets up there now.
Isn't that a wonderful place for them to be consolidated?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're getting ready to try to wade through this thing or, you know, write them off in some way or hide it or something, right? But it's not going to work, is it? Is the market bigger than anything or anyone?
Well,
in the end, or used to be, right?
The derivative market is a bigger house of cards than anybody can conceivably imagine.
Yes.
And if there was a significant enough financial shock, anywhere in the world, actually, it could trigger a collapse of the derivative market that would literally destroy the entire debt-based banking system in the world. It could literally destroy the entire system. I've had some thoughts, George, by the way, since we brought up this whole financial issue.
Okay.
If the United Nations is dead set to destroy capitalism.
Right.
And if these bankers of the world, including central banks, if they are in bed with these people, which we know they are.
They are, yeah.
Does this create a moral hazard where somebody might get the idea at some point, let's help capitalism along a little bit. You know, let's just kind of help it to the grave.
In other words, collapse it into bankruptcy or something like that, what you're
saying.
That's
exactly right. It wouldn't take much at this point, would it?
You know, there's a concept called odious debt. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Well, odious debt is debt created unconstitutionally by so-called governments and so forth.
Okay.
And this is Canadian. There's a woman out of Canada written a book on this. So it happened in Iran, I think, under the Shah.
Anyway,
some people are claiming that some of this debt creation is not legitimate or is odious debt.
Okay, gotcha.
There's a legal, platform to argue there, legal, argument there, So, so what you're saying, what you're putting forward the last few minutes was maybe they're setting up capitalism to kill it then, right?
Well, I'm just suggesting. That there is a moral hazard.
What you're saying though is a perfect way for them to do it, because then they can say that these markets, and I've been hearing similar things like this, these markets under capitalism are out of control and they need to be regulated more, and see what I mean? Huh? What I've heard, Patrick, more than anything is capitalism is not working anymore. You heard this?
I have.
I've heard that by different factions and different groups, meaning that this opens it up to killing it off, right?
What people don't understand, especially economists, it's true that the global economy makes no sense to anybody. If you're a trained, educated economist, you can't apply your traditional formulas anymore to figure out what's happening. You can't justify it looking backwards. You can't predict it looking forward. That's pretty much of a fact right now. But what people do not realize, this is caused because there are two economic systems that are fighting to the death in the global space. Technocracy is duking it out with capitalism right now, even as we speak, because the United Nations has already taken this everywhere. Now they're just going to give us more of it to lock the system in. They're fully intending that capitalism will lose in the end. But the reason the economics don't make any sense in the world anymore is because these two economic systems are worse than even oil and water. They not only don't mix, they're hostile to each other. They're like matter and antimatter, if you will.
Right.
And everywhere they touch, you have economic chaos. We see it. I see it all over the world. I don't try and even explain it anymore. But I see it happening. When I see that kind of chaos and look into it, I say, okay, that's it. The environmental movement, the sustainable development movement, got into the economic system, slipped at a Mickey, if you will, and all of a sudden, all you know what breaks loose. Craziness.
Well, these companies now, being controlled and run by computers and everything else, then those guys running those computers have a lot of power, don't they?
Indeed they do.
See, and without them, and you have to go to them and rely on them, because the management sometimes, in some cases, doesn't understand what they know.
That's right. They don't.
So they're sort of looking to these technocrats like you're talking about, and they're behind the scenes running the place, right?
That's the unfortunate thing about technocrats. They're difficult to get your hands on because you got to find them. You got to identify.
Yeah, you got to find them. Who? Golly, man. Now, we've got about 4.5 minutes to go. Well, what would be some of your concluding remarks, Patrick Wood?
Well, I want to say, number one, even if you've listened to this interview intently, and even if you've listened to some of my other interviews on the Internet intently, that is no substitute for reading Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. You need to read the book. I can't stress that enough. People think they get enough information from an interview that, oh, I know everything about that now. No, you don't. Trust me.
Give us your website. You can order on and stuff like that.
My book website is technocracyrising.com. Right. Technocracyrising.com. I like to send out autographed copies when people buy from my website. But the book's available on Amazon as well, Amazon.com. You just go search for Technocracy or Patrick Wood. You'll find the book immediately. There is a Kindle version available. If you like to read on electronic reader. And I have to say, if anybody ever would ever have a thought of buying a couple of cases of books in order to give away to all of your state legislators or, you know, county officials or city officials or whatever to try and spread the educational process around a bit, I have a deeply discounted schedule, wholesale schedule for quantity books on technocracyrising.com.
Okay. Well, that's really good. I think we started out a little bit talking about the Pope and stuff, and I think this dovetails into your book perfectly. What do you think?
It does. It does. What the Pope is doing right now is just it's like almost the final loop to this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. They've got to marshal the public, opinion to support what action they might take in the future. And but they've schooled all of our school children into ecological and love nature and protect nature, and at the cost of prosecuting people now if they don't agree with you. Political correctness taken to it. Well, you know, the latest thing is this micro transgressions and stuff like that. You heard about that?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, they're taken now to where it's gotten really crazy. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And it's so out of control and everything else. But anyway, any other comments that you'd have about a minute?
Well, no, I would just encourage people to watch current events very closely right now. I wouldn't watch too much necessarily on your national TV because that's just going to poison your mind. But watch the newspapers, you know, watch the foreign press as well. You often get better intelligence coming out of, like the Telegraph or, you know, some of the British newspapers, Financial Times even. I don't like it for some reasons, but you'll often find better articles written overseas than you will here in our own country. So watch this whole thing carefully. We're seeing history, potentially, we're seeing a sea change in history right now where the history of the world may well be changed forever.
Oh, I tell you. Well, thank you for being with us, Patrick Wood. We appreciate all your time and trouble on this interview, and certainly all your work on Technocracy Rising, that your latest book.
Thank you, it
is a great book. I recommend it highly. But thank you very, very much, and good night.
Yep, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you.